Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Naked Neuroscience, the podcast dedicated to the most fascinating organ in the human body, our brains. I'm your host, James Titko from the Naked Scientist team. Today, I speak to world-leading memory expert Charan Ranganath in an extended interview. I'm pleased to be sharing what I hope will be an unforgettable interview with a very special guest. Dr. Charan Ranganath has been a pioneer in the use of brain imaging techniques to study how our brain remembers past events. And now he's written a book on the topic, sharing his insights. It's called Why We Remember. In our conversation, we talk about the parts of the brain most important in forming memories, how our propensity for looking favourably on the past is sometimes used against us, and why we might be more forgiving of the occasional memory-related blunder by certain politicians in front of the cameras. Dr. Charan Ranganath is a director of the Memory and Plasticity Program and a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of California at Davis. He's also the author of the book Why We Remember. Charan, thanks for being with me. Before we get into the substance, I want to touch briefly on the style of the book and particularly the sheer number of musical references in it. Chapters with titles like Where Is My Mind? More Than a Feeling. References throughout the text to musicians. One that sticks out is George Harrison's alleged plagiarism. And the book even begins with the quote, "My ability to remember song lyrics from the 80s far exceeds my ability to remember why I walked in the kitchen." Music, clearly a big part of your life.
Yes, music is a very big part of my life. And when I wrote this book, it was a very personal thing for me to be able to write something that both tracked the development of my own ideas, but also my life in this field of science. And so people who are personally attached to Proust or William James or these kinds of things that people often cite in their popular books on memory, for me, these are my touchstones. And it gave me a lot of happiness to be able to put Picasso, Akira Kurosawa, the Wu-Tang Clan in the same sentence.
Terrific. And as I understand it, you've been looking at using music as part of your science from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's right. Music is very evocative for being able to put people in a mood. And so in our early research, when I was interested in the effect of emotion on thinking, actually we ended up using music to evoke memories and then hoping that the memories would actually affect people's mood. And that was exactly what happened. So everything else in that experiment didn't work out. It kind of went pear-shaped. But nonetheless, it worked out enough that I was able to publish it. But really, the impact on me was much greater, I think, than the impact on the field in terms of my thinking about how deeply personal memory is. And actually, since writing the book, I've been just enormously touched by the fact that many times after I give public talks or even with people who are, I would think, you know, like journalists, for instance, they feel almost compelled to tell me their own memory stories. So,
yeah, you mentioned one of the first things people always say to you as a memory expert is, why is my memory so poor? And it turns out, because that I feel like applies to me, you've got a positive message for me.
Don't get me wrong, I tell myself the same thing. Why am I so forgetful? And I'm always forgetting things, as I mentioned in the book. It frustrates the heck out of me. And I'm sure this happens for many other memory researchers, because many of us often study what we're not good at. I mean, you probably see this a lot in science. They call it me-search. If you actually quantify people's memory for at least meaningless, arbitrary details, which is a lot of what's happening in our daily lives, we don't remember the overwhelming majority of them after at least 2 days. In fact, the majority of our experiences within a day will be lost. And so that gives you an idea that we're being very unrealistic if we think that on average we're supposed to remember everything. I think the expectation should be that we're not supposed to remember things. And then the question is, why do we remember anything at all? Which is why where the title of the book came from.
So there it is. That's what you're trying to achieve. You're trying to switch the focus from kicking ourselves over forgetting our aunt's birthday and instead trying to appreciate the amazingness of why things stick in our brains at all. Let's talk a bit about that process. What parts of the brain are specifically engineered to help us with this memory formation process?
There's different levels of this question, which is because it's a very big question. A lot of the questions that are the simplest are actually the hardest to answer, as it turns out. I think many memory researchers would say that every area of the brain is involved in some kind of learning or memory. But in terms of what people would colloquially talk of as memory, we typically are thinking of episodic memory, which is my specialization. It's this ability to be able to remember particular past events, be it where you put your keys or be it things like your 16th birthday or something, right? These are particular events that we want to be able to bring back to mind. And so that ability to be able to remember something that happened just once at a particular unique place and time is dependent on the hippocampus. So it's a brain area that's tucked deep inside the brain, and it's actually evolutionarily fairly old. So reptiles have a rudimentary form of a hippocampus. Fish have a rudimentary form of a hippocampus. I think what makes the human brain especially, or at least the primate brain especially notable, is that we have another area called the prefrontal cortex. And there's some parts of the prefrontal cortex that may be even uniquely human.
You describe it in the book as being like the CEO of the brain. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so for a long time, people thought that the prefrontal cortex didn't do anything, or they didn't understand what it did, which is why frontal lobotomies were quite popular in the 1960s. And it's now very clear that the prefrontal cortex is extraordinarily important. And it's not important because it does any one thing. So Alan Baddeley, among others, who's a great British psychologist, used the term central executive, which became popularized as executive function. And it's an apt analogy because essentially you try to give an executive any kind of a real job like mopping the floors, doing accounting or something, good luck. They're not going to do it very well. And so the job of an executive is not to do any one thing well, but rather to take a bird's eye view of all of the offices that are part of a bigger project, a bigger endeavor, and orient them towards a particular goal. As a result, if you lose the prefrontal cortex, which would be responsible for executive functions in the brain, you still have all the abilities to walk, to talk, to think, but you can't remember very well, you can't pay attention very well. Anything that you need to do that's based on your own goals, you lose that ability. So basically, it's not about memory per se, but it's about using information in memory to guide what you do. And to be able to focus what you do on your goals and be able to form memories for things that you're really focused on, which would be like what I call in the book as learning with intention.
And then I suppose to go a level deeper in terms of the way we perceive the world, our sensory functions, how are they then translated into things we discard or things that lodge themselves in the brain? You draw the distinction, don't you, between the thinking and the remembering self?
This is actually paraphrased from the Nobel-winning psychologist Danny Kahneman. And Danny talked about this idea that there's the experiencing self, which is the person who lives in the moment. And then there's what he called the remembering self, which is essentially after an event is over, it's the person that makes choices and decisions based on not what they experienced, but what they remembered. And so as an example, you might have had a holiday recently and you spent a long time in queues, whether it's in the airport, you spend a long time in the queue at baggage claim, then you find out some of your baggage is missing, blah, blah, blah. 20% of that time is spent relaxing, but a good amount of that time is actually spent doing things that are quite unpleasant. But the next time you're planning, you will probably plan a holiday for that 20% of the time that was pleasant, and you probably won't put much thought into the parts of the trip that were unpleasant. And so I know Kahneman argues that's very irrational, but I think the brain is designed that way for a reason, and it's designed that way because it's about holding on to what's important and grabbing what is most useful to guide our future decisions. And sometimes it's going to be things that are biologically important, things that give us pleasure, things that give us states of desire, or things that give us a sense of love or attachment. And you can see basically during any of these kinds of experiences that there's these chemicals called neuromodulators that are released in the brain. Many of your listeners probably know about them, like serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine. These chemicals do generally have a similar effect, which is they affect the way that you pay attention in the moment, and they affect plasticity, meaning that they solidify these changes in the strength of connections between neurons, which are essentially the unit in the brain of computing particular things, whether it's perception or thought or memory.
And I know you're not necessarily having written this book to dish out advice on how to improve our memory, but what are the things, I suppose, that hurt our ability to remember things? And am I right in thinking that the modern world has kind of supercharged these factors and made them more pronounced?
So, I mean, why don't we remember many things? The typical reason has to do with competition. If you have an experience that you formed a memory for that's very distinctive, it just stands out relative to everything else, those are the experiences that you're going to be able to capture the best. The modern world, I think, is not the problem in and of itself as much as our meeting the demands of the modern world, right? So, for instance, in theory, my smartphone was supposed to make life easier, and instead, now any time that I'm not doing anything, I feel this urge to check my phone, whether it's an urge to check email or an urge to check text messages, thinking about what's happening on Facebook or whatever, can take us away from the present moment, which isn't necessarily bad, except the problem is that if my goal is to actually pay attention to and remember this conversation that you and I are having, then the thing is that every time that I switch, even for a moment in this thought process, I'm losing a little bit of executive resources just to switch over to this new thought that I have. And then I have to use executive function to pull back into the conversation. There's actually memories that are formed at those points, which we would call event boundaries. So an event boundary could be even something as simple as my changing the topic of conversation to answering this question. Now I've changed the topic, and now I have to say, wait, what were we talking about again? I've now formed this new model of what's going on because I'm telling you something entirely new. But now I have to switch back and forth, and that requires me to recall, effortfully recall something from just a moment ago when I was talking to you. If we're not connecting those dots in the moment because we're constantly switching back and forth, what happens is that you have a bunch of fragments that are competing because it seems like, even though it should be one continuous conversation, in your memories, you've encoded a bunch of things that are unrelated to each other.
Is memory something that needs to be trained to be maintained? We talked about how we outsource a lot of our tasks that we would have had to do ourselves to our phones, for example, storing appointment times or phone numbers or things. In the book, you talk about early man having this necessity to remember which fruit is poisonous or which body of water is crocodile infested. Do the different taxes of the modern world mean we're losing something as opposed to our ancestors?
Yeah, I've heard this argument of, you know, you use it or you lose it, and memory is like a muscle or whatever. I don't adhere to that view, and I've yet to see any compelling evidence for that view. And I think most neuroscientists would agree that we are constantly learning. The problem is that sometimes that learning can mean that the plasticity that we have in the brain throughout our lifetime can mean we start to lose things that we've already learned if we are not careful. So what I would say is that it's not so much a use it or lose it thing, but are we using it the right way? Are we using it to remember what we want? Because if you can't remember everything, then the question is, okay, well, does it matter? I don't want to remember most things I've experienced. Like anytime I get a temporary password and I have to enter it into my phone or my computer just long enough to reset it to something meaningful. Think about every one of those temporary passwords. It's like it's a lifetime of junk that you never want to accumulate. Our cave person trying to figure out which fruits are poisonous and where the saber-toothed tigers are, their priorities are pretty clear, and the brain's biology is quite optimal for figuring this stuff out without actually a whole lot of pontificating. And then there's things that you can see in many traditional cultures in terms of things like navigation abilities, and there's Polynesian cultures which just an extraordinary feats in being able to navigate just by looking at the stars and so forth. So there are all these abilities that are out there, but it's a matter of finding the right skills and adopting the right practices for remembering what you need to remember and dumping the rest.
How is the way our memory works, as you've described it, the episodic nature of it, used against us in certain cases? I'm thinking this idea of nostalgia and rose-tinted glasses. I think it's probably best if we start by asking why that happens. What is that phenomenon?
Yeah, so it was. I was just talking to somebody who studied nostalgia and history, and basically one of the things that people always tell her is nostalgia ain't what it used to be. And I think that captures, though, the slippery nature of nostalgia. But the bottom line is that in our modern day, we tend to think of nostalgia in a positive way, and it can be enormously good for mental health to think of times in our life that were very positive. And on average, people have a positive memory bias, meaning that they remember positive events better than negative or bland events. So as a result, it can give us good feelings in the present to think about these positive experiences, except that sometimes what can happen is that people take the wrong interpretation from that. And the wrong interpretation could be things used to be so great. Whether it's for me personally, when I was young, everything was so rosy and life was good and I was free. And now I'm like, you know, not able to like hang out, you know, after two drinks, I get a hangover and constantly having to worry about falling or whatever it is, right? Or in the case of national or collective memory, there's things like, oh, our country used to be great and now it's terrible. What happened? Oh, it must have been these outside forces. And that nostalgia can get weaponized, but it's, I call it toxic nostalgia. And it reflects a memory bias. So right now there's a lot of nostalgia for how America used to be great and how it was not great. And some of this concerns, for instance, the loss of industrialization. And I lived through the 70s, and there was a big loss of industrialization at that point. Instead of China, people were very worried about Japan and so forth. So these things are not new to this time. Back in the 70s, there was nostalgia for the 50s. Yeah. So now I find it odd that I find it very difficult to accept that people are nostalgic about the 80s and 90s now. It doesn't feel like it was that long ago for me. But that positive memory bias can lead you to adopt an incorrect view of how things were relative to how things are now.
While I've got you, a memory expert, I thought it was very pertinent to touch on one of the issues that's going to be the defining ones of the next generation related to memory, and that's how it changes as we age. It's estimated that one in three of us will go on to develop dementia, and with an aging population, perhaps because of medical advances in so many other fields, this one is becoming a more prominent concern, and there's a lot of resources and scientific interest in finding the causes and potential cures for it. How does our memory change as we age? And I suppose, how doesn't it? What are the misconceptions?
Well, I think one of the big misconceptions, and especially recent research has really revealed this misconception, is that everybody gets worse as they get older. And what we're finding is if you look at longitudinal studies, meaning like studies that follow the same person over, say, 10 years, what you find is that there's enormous variability, and some people will show a steep decline and some people will show virtually no change in cognition for a very long time. And you can see this in many people who are like, you know, in their 80s or even higher, who are just exceptionally with it and have great memory. And so I think this is an important point to make, is that knowing someone's age in and of itself doesn't tell you a whole lot. The second point is that if you do follow the averages, though, on average, performance on some kinds of memory get worse. So what I mean by this is your knowledge about the world tends to stick around and is quite stable and can even improve over time. And your old memories, the ones that you've carried from your younger days, tend to stick around. But basically, the most common change that happens is that you are more forgetful, often because you are losing this executive function. And this is very common. Actually, we think it starts after the age of 30, which is quite shocking. But it's a decline that happens throughout adulthood. And you'd be hard-pressed to find an older person who feels like that they find words that come to mind and they can, that they're not any more distractible or they're not any more absent-minded than they used to be 20 years earlier, right? And that's largely due to changes in the prefrontal cortex, both structurally but also in terms of chemical changes that can happen and so forth. And so that is a big part of it. And then, of course, there are other changes that can happen to the hippocampus, like we talked about. And sometimes those changes are basically a very early development of Alzheimer's disease. But that's where the variability really kicks in. I think there's some controversy, but I think one compelling line of thinking is that there's a point over normal age-related development where you can get a forking off into this pathway towards Alzheimer's or other neurodegenerative diseases. And basically, these diseases tend to be caused by proteins that misbehave. And so I was just talking to somebody who studies longevity, for instance, and these things are kind of inevitable at some point. But the question is, when does that happen? And it's enormously variable.
A certain person whose memory has been of particular interest to the press of late for a number of reasons is Joe Biden. So there was a report written about the fact he couldn't recall necessarily the exact years he was vice president or when, or the details of when his late son died. Being president, there's a whole lot of interruptions to the way our memory works, as we were describing earlier, which could account for some of that. But people have also pointed to his age.
So people have been talking about Biden's age for a while in the U.S. And to be clear, Trump is not much younger. I believe he's 77 and Biden's 81, memory serves. so within the realm of age-related changes in thinking and memory, that's a negligible difference, really. And they're both known for memory lapses. But the reason this came up, especially for Biden, was that there was a special counsel that was investigating Biden for some alleged issues. And they didn't turn up any evidence in this investigation that was sufficient to suggest that he had committed any wrongdoing. But part of the report contained a statement that effectively they couldn't prosecute him because people would see him as an elderly man with poor memory. And this really struck me because as a memory researcher, I want to know what they mean by this. And so I looked at the report, and at least the cases that I saw that were used as evidence for a poor memory were either cases which were not in line with what the implication was, or they were cases where it was not even a memory thing at all. And so what I mean by this is that, as I mentioned earlier, as we get older, it's often not a matter of having no ability to form memories. But at least in healthy aging, it's usually a case of not being able to find the information that you're looking for when you need it. One of the things that they talked about in special counsel's report is, you know, under this questioning, while there was all this stuff happening in Israel, he was being asked about the year that his son died. And he said he couldn't remember the right year. And that might seem, well, how do you not remember that, right? But it's not that he doesn't remember any experiences from the time that his son died, or that he doesn't remember that his son died. It's just he wasn't able to pull up this one detail. And I think we've all actually had these experiences where we couldn't pull up the right detail when we needed. And so what I'd be worried about is that if he couldn't remember that something happened, as opposed to some detail about what happened. And then there's other things like his notable gaffes, so to speak, where he was saying, and I think this really hurt him, in his press conference right after these allegations by the special counsel, he inadvertently referred to the president of Egypt as the president of Mexico. Now, I think it's fair to give the president the benefit of the doubt that he knows the difference between Mexico and Egypt. And likewise, Donald Trump did a major gaffe where he accidentally confused Nikki Haley, who's a Republican opponent, with Nancy Pelosi, who's like a Democrat, who's like extremely unpopular amongst Republicans in the U.S. And he clearly knows the difference between the two people, I would hope. And so, again, these are things where it's not that they have a memory problem at all. It's that they pulled out the wrong name or the wrong word at a given time, and they were slow to catch the error, which is typical of healthy aging. Now, it's fair to ask, okay, that's fine. So you have changes in frontal function as you get older. Does that affect your ability to do the job? And I think there's memory issues that are relevant to doing the job, but there's also memory issues that can be compensated for by assistance and by a phone, for instance. And so I think the question is that memory is one ability, but that's episodic memory too. There's knowledge about the relevant facts, knowledge about foreign countries. I mean, think about if you're running the United States or if you're running a powerful country like the UK, you have to know about countries all over the world. You have to know about laws relevant to the economy. You have to be thinking about military and diplomatic priorities. I mean, there's a lot of knowledge that needs to be there. And I think we don't place enough importance on the fact that people with a lot of years have a lot of knowledge, and it's quite stable over time.
I suppose it's nice that these gaffes, they happen to the best of us or the worst of us, depending on where you stand on this. Charon, thank you so much for your insights. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. I'm a fan of the show, and I'm happy to be doing this.
And do remember to check Charon's book out. It's called Why We Remember. That's all for this edition of Naked Neuroscience. I hope you'll join us next time. I'm James Titko. Thanks very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.